Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, April the 7th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. A military tribunal in Burkina Faso sentences in absentia former President Blaise Compaoré to life imprisonment for his role in the murder of his predecessor, Thomas Sankara.
And one of his greatest achievements is that he gave them the possibility to believe in themselves in order, you know, to change the course of history.
And millions of Nigerian citizens are struggling to make phone calls after telecom operators blocked users who have not linked their numbers to the National Identification Scheme. In Malawi, press freedom groups are expressing concern after police interrogated a reporter over his sources and took his equipment. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And for our top story, in Burkina Faso, a military tribunal has sentenced in absentia former President Blaise Compaoré to life imprisonment for his complicity in the murder of his predecessor, Thomas Sankara, in a 1987 coup. The tribunal found Compaoré guilty of an attack on state security and complicity in murder and concealment of a corpse. Two of Compaoré's former top associates, Hyacinthe Kafando and Gilbert Diendere, were also sentenced to life imprisonment. Sankara, who attained iconic status after his death, came to power as a young, charismatic Marxist revolutionary at the age of 37. Compaoré was a former best friend to Sankara and ruled Burkina Faso for 27 years before being ousted in another coup in 2014. He fled to Ivory Coast, where he is still believed to live. So why did it take over 3 decades for justice to be served? And does this verdict bring closure to the family of Sankara and the millions of his supporters in Burkina Faso and around the African continent? For that, I reached Professor Nyaka Lagoke. He's a political analyst, author, and founder of the organization Convention for Pan-Africanism and Progress, based at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania.
Yes, Sankara was a person of integrity, and he showed the example to the people of Burkina Faso. And one of his greatest achievements is that he gave them the possibility to believe in themselves in order, you know, to change the course of history. That's why Thomas Sankara is eternal. He symbolized the hope and the dreams and the aspirations of Africa that is moving towards its unity and that is claiming its dignity.
And what does this ruling mean for the people in Burkina Faso?
The first thing is that it is important. And I want to quote Dr. King, who said that the arc of the universe is very long, but it always bends towards justice. So it is not just the people in Burkina Faso. It is people like me and many other ones across the globe who wanted justice for Thomas Sankara because you cannot come and kill somebody in impunity. And then because you have the support of the West, and then you think that you can get away with that. I'm talking about Blaise Compaoré. So we wanted that to happen. We waited, and it happened, so we have a sense of relief. And okay. I think that when the people I've spoke to, this is how they feel, and then this is the same feeling that I have myself.
And why did it take long for this justice to be served?
Because the person who orchestrated his assassination and who was condemned to the in absentia, Blaise Compaoré, was in power for 27 years, and he had the support of the West, and then particularly France, and then he was using all the power that he could in order to, you know, to rule and then to prevent such a thing to happen. So because he was overthrown or because he was taken out of power by a people's power movement, then now we can see that people could organize the trial, and that's why it took so long. But when he was in power, that was something that was not possible. And now that he's not in power, and then people organized and booked the people in Burkina Faso under Roch Kabore, and later on under the current president, Damiba, they seem to be on the right side of history.
That was Professor Nyaka Lagoke, a political analyst, author, and founder of the organization Convention of Pan-Africanism and Progress. I reached him in Pennsylvania.
Voice of America.
And millions of Nigerian citizens are struggling to make calls from their phones. This after telecom operators on Tuesday blocked users who have not yet linked their numbers to the National Identification Scheme. Authorities introduced the exercise last year in a bid to address rising insecurity. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The barring of phone numbers unlinked with the Nigerian National Identification System followed an order by President Muhammadu Buhari on Monday. The Association of Licensed Telecoms Operators of Nigeria, ALTEN, said all members have complied with the government order and that out of 198 million subscribers, about 73 million have been barred. In Abuja this week, hundreds of affected citizens swarmed service centers trying to fix the problem, including Abuja resident Josh Okere.
The crowd was just too much. This goes to show how devastated the people are not being able to carry out their basic routine calls and businesses. You know, I'll say that this is a huge loss, a very big one to both the federal government and the telecommunication systems in Nigeria as well.
Nigerian authorities have been battling insecurity spreading across the country's northwestern states for years. Armed gangs often attack communities, killing and taking hostages. To address the problem, authorities last year launched a national scheme to link phone numbers of citizens with the National Identification System. Telecoms operators say many citizens ignored last year's directive and missed several extended deadlines. Gbenga Adebayo is the chairman of the Telecoms Operators Association.
We've been on this now for 14 months. Many people didn't respond to the call to link their SIM with their name. And so we are where we are. But certainly the last 24 hours has witnessed enormous pressure. It's been a lot of pressure at the various experience centers. There's also been a lot of pressure on the systems. It has been a lot of concerns expressed by members of the public.
Last week, armed gangs attacked a moving train, killed 8 people and kidnapped an unspecified number of people. By some estimates, the abducted people are more than 100. VOA reported barely 24 hours after the attack, the terrorists made contacts with families of abductees demanding ransom. Authorities say proper identification can help track criminals, but some experts have raised issues of privacy. However, for now, many will be trying to unblock their numbers as soon as possible. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Daybreak Africa continues. Press freedom groups and the US and British embassies in Malawi have expressed concern after police interrogated an investigative reporter over his sources and confiscated his equipment. Gregory Gondwe says police held him for 4 hours Tuesday in a failed attempt to get him to reveal his contacts. Gondwe had published a story in March about the government's alleged secret dealings with a businessman who is on trial for corruption, as Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre in Malawi.
The arrest of journalist Gregory Gondwe with a platform for investigative journalism came after Malawi's Attorney General Thabo Chakacha Nyirenda announced he would take action against those who leaked a document meant for the Anti-Corruption Bureau. According to the document that Gondwe used in his story published on March 30, it appears that Nyirenda allowed the government to make payments to the corruption suspect, Zuneth Sata. That move runs counter to Nyirenda's actions in January when he publicly terminated all Sata's contracts with the government and restricted any payment on the same. In his story, journalist Gondwe said the government had secretly paid millions of dollars to Sata's company, Marachite FZE, to procure 8 anti-riot water cannons for police. Gondwe told VOA Wednesday the police were demanding that he reveal how and from whom he got the documents.
The said story is factual. All they are trying to find out is the source, which is something that cannot happen in journalism. The moment I'm going to give them my source, that means I'm killing I mean, it's the death of journalism. So from the word go, I told them that this is a futile attempt from your side because you are not going to get anything from me.
Teresa Ndanga is the chairperson for the Media Institute for Southern Africa in Malawi. She told a local radio the arrest contradicts government's claim of respecting media freedom in Malawi.
It's quite unfortunate that we seem to be going backwards instead of really moving forward. We currently have the Access to Information Law, in which one of the provisions is that journalists are protected from revealing their sources.
In a joint statement Tuesday, the U.S. and British embassies in Malawi condemned the move and asked police to immediately return the confiscated equipment to Gondwe and respect any private information found there. James Kadadzela is assistant commissioner for the police. He told VOA Wednesday via a messaging app that police did not arrest the journalist.
Mr. Grigory Gondwe was not arrested by the police. In fact, he was invited to Southwest Region Police Headquarters for an interview on the ongoing investigations police are conducting regarding an online news story that was published by an organization where Mr. Grigory Gondwe is working for.
But Gondwe, who was released 4 hours later, says he doesn't believe it was an interview.
Because when they took me to the police, they kept me in the criminal investigations department room. At one time, I asked to go to the bathroom, but before they could even release me, the officer that was guarding me had to seek permission first.
Police unconditionally released Gondwe Tuesday and retained his equipment Wednesday. Kadadzela said the police might invite and interview Gondwe again if they feel they need to. Government spokesperson Gospel Kazako says in a statement the government welcomes the release of Gondwe and that it fully subscribes to the values of free independent media. Gondwe says the statement smacks of double standards and that the government seems contradicting itself. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Human Rights Watch and Mali's National Commission on Human Rights have called for an independent investigation into an alleged massacre of hundreds of civilians by government troops and suspected Russian mercenaries. After reports surfaced of the killings last month in the central village of Mora, Mali's military government said their forces had killed 203 terrorists. But witness accounts contradict the official version of those killed and offer some of the clearest evidence that Mali's military is working with Russian mercenaries despite the military's denial.
VOA has this report.
On a rooftop in Bamako Tuesday evening, a group of around 15 men sat together and spoke Fulani in hushed tones. They arrived that afternoon from the village of Mora in central Mali, where reports of killings by the Malian army and Russian mercenaries have been circulating since last week. They say they are here in Bamako to testify for a human rights organization. In the sparsely furnished living room in the house below, one man described how the killings began. He says helicopters arrived on the morning of Sunday, March 27th, and began shooting indiscriminately. He says white soldiers who spoke neither French nor English descended from the helicopters on the edge of town, with a smaller number of Malian army soldiers, and began sorting men into groups. For 5 days, town residents and those who were visiting for market day were seated on the ground, under guard by the Malian and foreign soldiers, while witnesses say summary executions were carried out. Most residents of Mora and the surrounding villages are ethnic Fulani, a traditionally pastoralist ethnic group spread across West Africa, who have long accused the Malian army of unfairly targeting them during anti-terrorism operations.
It is Wuli and Bambara. Wuli on Seke coming Savedike left.
He says, they told us Wuli in Bambara. Wuli, we know that means get up. They chose another one. Hey, Wuli, get up. They made maybe 12, 15 people stand up. They made them get in a line. They brought them barely 100 meters away. They made them kneel. They had dug a big ditch. They made them put their hands on their heads. Then they killed them in front of everyone. Even in front of our children, he says. Many governments have accused Mali's military government of working with mercenaries from the Wagner Group, a private Russian military company with alleged links to the government of Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Malian government denies the accusations, saying it only works with official Russian trainers. Both the Russian embassy in Bamako and President Putin have denied an official Russian military presence in Mali, although Putin said during a recent press conference that Mali has the right to work with private Russian military contractors. Human Rights Watch published a report on the events in Mora on Tuesday, including reports of more than 200 men killed. From Washington, Corin Difka, West Africa director at the organization, says Human Rights Watch spoke with 19 witnesses who were present in Mora during the five-day operation.
If people are killed in this manner, summarily executed, be they suspects or civilians, it's against Malian law, international law, and on a practical level, it serves to fill the ranks of the violent non-state actors.
Within Mali, the National Commission on Human Rights, or CNDH, a governmental agency, has also called for an investigation of events in Mora. Agibu Borde, the president of the commission, says it's important that an independent and credible investigation be conducted, as many times probes into state actions take place without results. He says that although the CNDH does not yet have formal proof of a Wagner presence in Mali, they are opposed to such military collaborations.
Nous savons que ce sont des structures qui ne respectent pas les droits de l'homme.
Borre says, we know that these are organizations that do not respect human rights. This is why we really fear interventions by these types of private military enterprises. The Malian army released a statement last week saying it killed 203 terrorists in an air and land operation in Mora. Another statement released Tuesday said the army had been the object of unfounded allegations of abuses against the civilian population. A Malian army spokesman reached by phone declined to comment. Last month, Radio France International and France 24 were taken off the air in Mali after RFI reported on alleged human rights abuses by the army near Diabali, Mali, also against the Fulani population. VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Ministers and senior representatives from the East African Community member states met in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, recently to discuss efforts aimed at addressing the migration issue in the region. The UN says there are about 195 million people, including refugees, asylum seekers, and internally displaced persons in East and Horn of Africa. Mohamed Abdika is the East and Horn of Africa Regional Director for the International Organization for Migration, or IOM. VOA reporter Ruben Kayama asked him to explain the ongoing efforts to establish a regional consultative process on migration for the region.
We're facing a situation where we talk about integration in the region. You have the East African Common Market Protocol. We have the issue of IGAD Free Movement Protocol itself. But we want to see how we can concretize this for the benefit of our citizens in this region. But also importantly, we also want to look at the labor rights of our people. If you look at the bilateral labor agreements that we've signed between member states in the Eastern Horn of Africa with the Gulf countries, are they beneficial to our citizens? Are their human rights being protected? How are we going to deal with the issue of irregular migration? We're having a large number of our citizens from this region who are crossing the Red Sea into Yemen, into Saudi Arabia. How are we going to protect them? To give you numbers, if you look at numbers concretely, if we talk about Ethiopia, we've issued an appeal of about $11 million to assist Ethiopian government in receiving about 100,000 Ethiopians who have been deported from Saudi Arabia. That just gives you the magnitude of the issue. When we talk about migrants from this region moving from Horn of Africa to Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, 2 years ago, last year, over 150,000 people go irregularly, not regularly, not with official documents, but irregularly. That gives you the magnitude of the irregularity of these issues, but we also have to worry about who's coming to our borders and who's not coming into our countries.
Do you see some progress, and how is the situation like now? Is it getting worse or is it getting better?
I can look at this in two ways. One is the region is expanding. We're seeing more member states joining the East African community, for example. Just yesterday, the heads of state of East African Community admitted Democratic Republic of Congo. Does that mean the regional integration is working? Yes, it is. It looks like if there is a reason for another member state to join, it means something is working. And if you look at the region, when we talk about migration, we see migration in three routes. You see one route that is of worrisome for us is the whole route of what we call the Eastern Route. the move from the Horn of Africa through the Red Sea to Yemen to Saudi Arabia, where we're having hundreds of thousands of our citizens from the Horn of Africa being smuggled and trafficked into the Gulf Peninsula. How are you going to deal with that as an irregular migration? Second is the issue about jobs. The reason why our citizens are moving, the young men and women are moving, is because there are no jobs being created in our region. How do we work with our governments to ensure that jobs are being created to be able to deal with the issue of migration, particularly irregular migration? How do we assist the member states in this region, both from East African Community and from IGAD, to look at jointly having what we call, they can have a collective negotiation power, particularly with the Gulf countries? The question is, what is the collective bargaining we can have together as members, as a bloc with the Gulf countries, and say, these are rights for our people that we're looking for. This is a minimum wage we're going to look up for. But also discuss the human rights of our migrants. When we have dead bodies of our migrants returned back from some of the Gulf countries, how are we going to deal with these issues?
That was Mohamed Abdeka, East and Horn of Africa Regional Director for the International Organization for Migration, who was speaking to VOA's Ruben Kayama in Nairobi. With more than 2 million Zimbabweans without national registration documents, Zimbabwe has launched a mobile exercise that will run until September and will allow citizens to get their papers. Access to the documents will allow citizens to vote in next year's nationwide elections. From Harare, Rutendo Mawere has this report.
Aaron Nepera is the permanent secretary in Zimbabwe's Ministry of Home Affairs, which helps to ensure that national registration documents are accessible to all citizens. Nepera explains the importance of the exercise.
The purpose of the mobile registration is to give our people, those who don't have death certificates, and any other document that they may so desire to have. This is particularly to allow them to register as voters.
The documents, which provides proof of citizenship, are also needed for access to other services like opening a bank account or purchasing property. Nepera admits that his ministry has not been able to provide the papers.
There has been quite a huge backlog in terms of issuance of IDs and birth certificates, which was occasioned by the COVID-19 pandemic, but also by the unavailability of the necessary consumables.
These consumables include a special type of imported paper and ink. Authorities say they had lagged the foreign currency to purchase them. The government says it is aiming to provide documents for at least 2 million Zimbabweans by the end of September. This after signing a partnership with Gasu Pasulis, a Lutanian company that is in charge of printing and producing the Zimbabwe's passports. Amos Nokwara, a Budiriro resident in Harare, says he has been without national identity papers since he lost his years ago.
I had failed to replace my lost identity document for the past 2 years. And I actually can say it was very difficult to get the document, as I had to travel to town, of which they were just serving me very few people per day. But now I'm happy that I can now get my document here at Buduro, where I stay. And the queue is much better. I personally think they should actually make this a decentralization payment.
A national inquiry on access to documentation by the Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission in 2020 revealed that over 2 million Zimbabweans lagged their papers. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. Well, thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voanews.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and on Facebook. Just search for VOA Africa. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead, Africa.